Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
You know, steelhead flies have always been my favorite patterns to create at the Vice. With steelhead flies, the door to creativity is wide open and the possibilities are endless. Now, you know, in reality, with steelhead fly tying, the anticipation often outweighs the outcome. I've tied hundreds of steelhead flies myself and caught fish on relatively few. Yet effective steelhead patterns exhibit certain qualities, and today's guest certainly understands this, and I'm looking forward to picking his brain. Scott Crosby, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Justin.
Man, it's good to talk to you tonight. Appreciate you taking the time. Before we dive into to who you are and what you do, I know you've been fishing a long time, and do you have a story teed up you can share with us?
Yep, I sure do. It actually happened on my very first fishing trip when I was just a young shaver. And I lived in Detroit, Michigan, and my mom and dad really weren't outdoorsy people, but they decided one day that they wanted to rent a cottage on a lake. I couldn't even tell you the name of the lake. And so they decided they were going to go there that weekend, and we packed up in the car, and I think I was 5 years old at the time. I can't remember. And we got there, and they started unpacking. Well, being the little young curious lad that I was, who really never been out of the city limits of Detroit, I was intrigued by this thing called a lake, which I've probably never seen one in my life. And so I decided I was going to go on my own little adventure. Well, they unloaded the car. Well, they didn't know that I was going to go on my own little adventure. And I remember meeting this man who had this long pole in his hand and a piece of line tied to the end of it and this coffee can sitting next to a 5-gallon bucket. And being 5 years old and not knowing better to really talk to strangers, I walked right up to him and said, "Hi." And he said, "Hello there." And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm fishing." And I said, "What's that?" And he kind of looked curiously at me. He goes, "You don't know what fishing is?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't know." He said, "Stand right there and watch us for a minute." And he reached in that coffee can, and at the time I didn't know what a nightcrawler was, and he picked in that can, and he grabbed himself a nightcrawler, and he pinched off a piece about an inch long. He threw it on that hook, which I didn't know that was either. He flipped her out in the water, and that had a bobber on, and I didn't know what that was either. And it went down, and he lifted it up, and lo and behold, he had a fish in his hand. And I was like, he goes, "That's fishing." And I said, "Can I try?" And he said, "Sure, come on over here." I can't remember the man's name, but I can picture his face and what I'm telling you like it was yesterday to me. Such a great memory.
Wow.
And 2 hours later, after they were looking for me, they found me with this guy, and we had a bucket full of bluegills. Just, you couldn't believe it.
And how old were you?
5.
Wow. So obviously your dad wasn't much of an angler.
No, not he. That was my stepdad, and he was a photographer. I don't think I ever saw a fishing rod or a gun in his hand ever.
Gotcha. So from that first experience, that lit the fire, huh?
It did. It lit the fire big time. I was so curious, and it was so fun.
That's awesome. At what point did you leave Michigan and move out west?
Yeah, so that's wow, there's a lot that went on between then and there. I lived in Michigan my whole entire life. I joined the Army. I was in the Army for 8 years. I got out of the Army. I was married. I went back to Michigan where I was from. Unfortunately, went through a horrible divorce. Ended up in Florida with my sister. Met this wonderful young lady named Heidi Anderson down in Florida, who was from Oregon. And so I had always wanted to go to Oregon after I got older in life. Just intrigued me, the pictures and the beauty and the fishing. And
sure.
But we ended up getting married in Florida. We stayed there for 2 years, and then I said, you know what, we need to get you back home to Oregon, closer to your family. So
which you had an ulterior motive there, right?
I had no problem going to Oregon because I was a little tired of Florida, just from the standpoint of it was great fishing, but the hunting, yeah, I didn't right. have any hunting there. And so we packed up and here we are in Oregon. We've been married 19 years now.
And so you've been living in Oregon for almost 20 years, roughly?
This will be our 17th year here at this house. So, yeah, almost 20 years in Oregon, yep.
Cool. And you live down near the Rogue River in southern Oregon, which is surrounded by some amazing fisheries. When you first ended up there, did you think you'd died and gone to heaven?
When it came to the salmon and steelhead, I did my research on the river, so I kind of knew what I was up against, and I knew the reputation that the Rogue had throughout the world, actually. And so, yeah, I was very pleased to be here, I can tell you that.
I bet. And so, you know, as kind of a newbie in Oregon, it can be kind of daunting trying to figure out how to catch salmon and steelhead in particular. Did you meet a group of anglers that kind of took you in, or did you just kind of figure it out on your own, or what was that process like?
You know, when I first got here, actually before we even moved here, there was a gentleman named Jerry James. He's no longer with us, but he was a very popular fly tyer in the community who had happened to go to church with Heidi when she was younger, and he became fond of a family friend of the, you know, just very fond of Heidi's family and Heidi. And so when we came out here on vacation, I was going to ask her dad for her hand in marriage. And we went over to talk to Jerry about where should we fish while we're out here. And he gave me a couple hints. And one of the things he told me was to read this particular book about Oregon waters. And I still have the book here. And basically what it did is it highlighted all the main waterways of Oregon and told you where to go and what to do. So I kind of had a little bit of help with where to look to do my research. But then it was all my research and all my, you know, having to spend time acting upon what I found.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. It's daunting to, you know, starting off with just a guidebook. That doesn't put you on the fish necessarily. You got to figure a lot of stuff out. And if you don't have,
you certainly do.
If you don't have someone to teach you that, it's not an easy thing to decipher, in my opinion. Right. For salmon and steelhead in particular. Like there's a pretty big learning curve.
What happened was after a bit of being here in Oregon, I was working for a gas line piping company. They laid me off because of hard times. And I ended up going down to Sportsman's Warehouse one day about 15 years ago. And I noticed the store manager was struggling trying to put tackle boxes away. And I said, you guys need some help around here. He goes, yeah, we do. You want a job? And I said, yeah, I'll be here in the morning. And that's how I got my job at Sportsman's Warehouse. And when I hit the Sportsman's Warehouse, boy, oh boy, did the contacts and the fishing stories and all the information and intel started coming in big time. I started meeting people and started getting into the inner circles of some communities that were really good. I I'm really good friends with John Hazlett and Dax Massad. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those troublemakers.
Yeah. Those guys know where the fish are.
Oh, and they're fantastic. They're a riot. Yes. They're a riot to hang out with, and they're damn good anglers.
Yes.
Well, that's really cool, Scott. When I first moved to Missoula, my first job was working in the fishing department at Sportsman's Warehouse. And it's the best first job I could have gotten when I moved here. The same experience you had, I'm sure. The people were super friendly, super knowledgeable. And over the course of 2 years, I learned what would have taken me probably 15 on my own, 15 or 20.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of where to go hunting and fishing. Yeah. Cool. Do you still work at Sportsman's Warehouse?
I sure do.
Do you really? Okay. Awesome. Wow. Yeah. You know, it's a good company to work for. A lot of the same people that I worked with, you know, back in 2006 or whatever. Yeah. You know, they're still there. The fishing manager's still there. The hunting manager's still there. One of the guys that used to be one of the department managers is now the store manager. And yeah, it's a good outfit. It's a good outfit. And cool. And in addition to that that career, you create some really, really gorgeous looking steelhead patterns, flies, and lures as well, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that side business you have?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. I appreciate you saying that. Many years ago, my mom, she collected antiques, and one of her favorite things to do was take a $50 bill and go down to an auction and see what she could turn around and buy antiques. Well, one day she went to an auction and she purchased this wooden 45 record box that she thought had a bunch of possibilities of good 45 records that she could turn around and make money on. Well, she opened it up and it was a fly tying kit. And she said, I know who to give this to. And so I still have most of everything in that kit that was original, and it's pretty archaic, but I made an attempt at tying my first fly, and that's been 25, 30 years ago, not too long ago, I guess, but it just went uphill from there. I really enjoy the creativity part of it. It's my happy place where when the world, in the crazy world in which we live, gets a little hairy for me, I just go and tie flies, and that's where I can drink coffee and relax.
Right. Yep. Exactly. So are there specific patterns that people commission you to tie for them, or you know, how does your business work?
Right. Okay. So that's a really good question too, because, you know, in fly tying, there's so many genres of style that you can be a part of. You can be a trout guy and specialize in dries, or you can be, you know, a traditional spey guy and tie the, you know, the real intricate spey flies. I became friends through a seminar I went to at Ashland Fly Shop with Jerry French. And I also became really good friends with Jay Nicholas. And I also became friends with Jason Osborne, the owner of the Portland Fly Shop. And those three guys, including Hazlett and a few others, were my mentors in teaching me the other side of spey fishing flies. And basically for me, I specialize in intruders and single station flies such as the hobo spey, or maybe even some would consider, I don't know if you'd consider it a single station, but the dirty hoe, streamer style, steelhead flies. That's my favorites to tie. I can tie them all. There's nothing I can't tie. If you show me a fly, I can sit down and tie it. Doesn't matter what it is. Even the, you know, married wings on the traditional fly tying or space stuff. My specialty, I love to tie intruders. I'm just an intruder freak.
Cool. And when you say single station, for the audience, what do you mean by that?
Right. So an intruder has got a front station and then a shank in between to a rear station. That, by definition, that's a true intruder. As to where, like, a hobo spay is just a shank with a single station on it, a single wrapping of your materials. To when, if you held an intruder up against a hobo spay, you would see definitely two, a front and a back, and on a hobo spay, you'd only see a front.
So, and on your patterns, do you tie these on tubes then? Are you a primarily a tube tire, or there's so many different ways to design intruders, and, you know, a lot of folks do it differently. Hazlett uses, what is that, Power Pro stuff, you know, that other tire you've got down there that guides on the Smith, you know, he likes to run coated wire. Everybody's got a little bit different style of building them. How do you build yours, Scott?
Right. So you're absolutely correct. There's really three avenues that you can tie your steelhead flies on, either a hook, a shank, or a tube. I do all three. My smaller traditional stuff for like trout spay and the half pounders here on the Rogue River, I tie on hooks. I specialize in shanks. It's my favorite. I would prefer a shank over a tube, but I also tie tubes as well. It just really is a personal preference. There's a lot of personal preference involved. And then when it comes to, you mentioned the different, ways to attach a hook to the flies, whether it be wire or, Hazlett likes to use the 30 pound, Berkeley Fireline.
30 pound Power Pro, right?
It's not Power Pro. It's Berkeley Crystal Fireline.
Fireline, thank you. That's right. I knew I was wrong. Yeah, Fireline.
And there's a reason. Right. There really is a reason for it, Justin. It's so that it's stiff, and your hook is in definitely a better position to, instead of on Power Pro. The only way your hook is going to be right directly behind your fly is if you have some pretty decent current to hold it up. As to where that Crystal Fireline holds it in a position to do so. And then Jerry French has the tube. If you attach a piece of tubing to the backside of your shank, you can hold that hook in a better position.
Right. Yep. I've seen that. Ultra tubing,
I believe he calls it. Yeah. That's pretty cool too.
Right. Right. Have you, Rich Zellman was the guy I was trying to think of. Do you know Rich Zellman?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
Oh, he guides on the Smith. Hazlett knows him, but he ties a really cool intruder. If you ever get a chance to look at one of his bugs, yeah, he put some time into them. They're gorgeous, but they're heavy for the Smith.
Right.
So, you know, I nicknamed one he gave me the tendonitis. And on that note, what qualities do you think a good winter steelhead fly has in terms of both fish attracting qualities and presentation qualities, or castability, however you want to term that?
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think first and foremost is, and Jerry French, who was my mentor and my main teacher on how to tie an intruder, and no better teacher in the world than to have him. Less is more is his motto. And so the first thing is castability. If you can't cast it to where you need to, where the fish are, then it's useless. You don't want to be casting half wet socks or half a chicken. You know, it just doesn't work. And then the other qualities that I like to put into my flies is the gentleman Jerry James that I mentioned earlier in the interview. He told me one time, he said, "Scott, make sure you tie your flies like a tank, because your reputation will be ruined if they fall apart, and it only takes one or two flies and people talking." And he said, "Build them like a tank." So I really make sure that, one, they're not going to come apart. But some of the qualities and traits that Jerry instilled in me is the fact that in a composite loop, which is a certain style of tying your materials and attaching them to the shank, you've got to have them be translucent, and they must have a large profile at the same time. So how does one take less material to make a bigger profile? Well, it's all done in the composite loop and how you support it underneath it. And with having the light go through it and being translucent, what that does is it makes it look like it's alive. And that is the trigger. Because you got to understand, these flies, you don't tie them to look good for me and you. You tie them to look good to the fish when it's wet and in the water. And you're trying to trigger that fish into eating that fly, whether it be out of reaction or hunger.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of that composite loop on YouTube or anywhere that folks could go look at?
Yeah, I do. I have on my Facebook page is probably the best place, or my Instagram. My Instagram is Fish for Him First, and then my Facebook would just be Scott Crosby. But you'll find pictures there, and I pretty much don't tie an intruder without a composite loop. I did the other night because I was trying some prototype materials that didn't require feathers, but the composite loop is where it's at, and I have plenty of pictures to look at on my social media for those.
Awesome. Can you explain that composite loop one more time to me, please?
Absolutely. The composite loop is it's basically a fancy man's dubbing loop. So if you were to be tying a fly and you made a dubbing loop and all you did is stick in it dubbing, then hence it's a dubbing loop. But a composite loop is made of, it's composed of different materials. I have dubbing in it. I have ostrich feathers in it. I could potentially have flash in it. There's all kinds of different materials that you can add to it, that when you spin it up and you pick it out, it just lays out beautifully when you go to wrap it.
Gotcha.
Very uniform way to lay material. Also,
and that's going to achieve that.
Strong way to do it. It doesn't break that way. They stay together longer. It's just a really good way to build a fly.
There you go. And that it also creates that translucence that you mentioned.
Yes.
Yeah, it kind of swims in the water. It traps kind of air bubbles. It kind of like similar to what a polar hair fiber does.
Yes.
Yep. Gotcha. Cool. Thank you for explaining that. That's an interesting tidbit that I don't think a lot of folks know about.
I also have a YouTube channel, and I have a pretty extensive couple recordings on how to make them, how to go about doing the composite loop.
Awesome. And we can find those if we just go to YouTube and type in Scott Crosby fly tying, I'm sure.
Yeah, just Scott Crosby will get you there.
Okay, great. Awesome. And then tell me about your lure designs as well, because you do, you build lures.
Absolutely.
Yeah, please.
So I have a good friend that I work with at Sportsman's Warehouse. His name is Colby Pearson, and he is on the Professional Apex Tour here on the West Coast. He's a professional angler. He may be, in my opinion, I think he's the premier go-to guy on swim baits. He is just an absolute wealth of treasure, of just plethora of knowledge when it comes to the swim bait side of things. On top of that, he knows his everything there is to know about bass fishing. Really good guy. Well, anyway, in working with him and following him and encouraging him in his pro status, he kind of lit a fire in me that I kind of let go of many years ago, and that was the aspiration to become a bass fisherman. I fished the Michigan BASS Federation circuit for many years. I had aspirations of going professional, but due to just some things in life that didn't work out, it didn't happen for me, but I kind of went away from it and just went to the fly fishing world and spey world, and stuck with the salmon and steelhead and I was okay with it. I knew what I knew a lot about bass fishing, but Colby recently lit a fire in me that made me want to start to build lures. And part of building the lures, you have to learn how to paint them. So I made an investment in some, what they call blanks, and I started painting these blanks to sell. And then what happened was Colby encouraged me to build and make my own bait that I could call my own. And then what you do is you turn around and you make a mold of that bait, and then you pour resin baits out of that mold, and then you paint the resin baits. And really, the money that can be made from your own custom bait is much more than just going and buying cheap Chinese blanks and painting them. So right now, my business has taken a little bit of a in the beginning, I was painting these blanks and had lots of Chinese blanks that I was painting and selling. But now I'm going to jump into it feet first with my own style and my own baits, and then I'm going to paint them and see what happens there. But it's still kind of in the beginning stages of that part of my business, but I really, really enjoy the painting part of it. It's a very creative, fun thing to do. I've always wanted to be kind of get the airbrush thing down as a young man and in my entire life, and I never did it. And I finally sat down and said, I'm going to teach myself how to do this. And lo and behold, I'm pretty good at tying an intruder, and I'm pretty good at painting a bait.
Man, I'm looking at these right now on your Instagram account, which is Fish for Fish, number four, him first. With yep. That's one ST. So Fish
correct.
For him first. And these are just beautiful. And the intruders, are amazing too. So folks, I implore you to go to Fish for Him First on Instagram and look at Scott's work here, whether you're a fly angler, a lure angler, or just appreciate art and custom made flies and baits. You've got to see this stuff. It is super cool.
The name of my company is Inner Sanctum Custom Flies, and I got that from George Cook.
Oh yes, George Cook. You bet. Inner Sanctum Custom Flies.
Yep, Inner Sanctum Custom Flies and Lures.
And your business is all basically just word of mouth, right? Like, but somebody could pop on here to Instagram and message you and order some flies or order some lures from you.
Correct. Yep.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.